Good to be with you on a Tuesday. Sean Pendergast, Seth Payne with you. Mike Tannenbaum, the former GM for the New York Jets yesterday on Get Up, kind of just off the cuff at the end of one of these segments, one of the many segments, what feel like daily segments that they do on the Houston Texans on these shows, said at the very end that, just kind of dropped this in, that no free agent will want to sign with the Texans if Deshaun Watson's situation is not clarified. Now, free agency begins mid-March. The first day of the new league year is March 17th. There's a couple days before that where teams are allowed to approach other teams' free agents. Legal tampering period, I guess we'll call it. Seth, are you buying that? That if Deshaun Watson's situation is not clarified by free agency, that no free agent is going to want to sign with the Houston Texans?
No, I'm not buying that because am I forgetting some era of history when, like, large numbers of teams that had uncertainty at the quarterback position didn't sign any free agents? Like, it doesn't now, it doesn't make them the preferred destination, obviously. When you're a free agent, you say, put yourself in the shoes of a young 25, 26-year-old man, and you've made some good money, but you've never had that huge, huge generational wealth contract yet. And two teams are offering you a contract. One of them is, let's say, I don't know, what's the middle? Let's say one's the Baltimore Ravens and one's the Houston Texans. All things being equal, yeah, you're going to take the Ravens if you don't know who the quarterback's going to be for the Texans. If the Texans offer $2 million more, you're jumping on the Texans like you're a horny dog and this is a French poodle. That's what you're doing. You're going to hump the hell out of that leg. So there's a premium you pay, I guess, because you're not going to win any ties with the good teams, but you're not always in competition with the Baltimore Ravens. In free agency, usually the teams are really only in competition with a few other teams, mm-hmm. because one team might want to spend in free agency on a defensive tackle. Another team might want to spend on cornerbacks, and they've got certain criteria. They need a certain type of cornerback. So, yeah, you're not going to be the preferred destination, but it's not like they're going to be unable to sign anybody. DJ Reader went to the Bengals last year, which apparently, well, you know what, they could have made the case that we're going to draft Joe Burrow. So that's not necessarily a great example.
Still, but the Bengals, guys go, though.
Yeah, guys sign with bad teams with bad quarterbacks all the time.
Yeah, I guess that when I think of this, and maybe he was just kind of using hyperbole to make a point on a TV show and get people looking at headlines or whatever. But if we're going to dig into it a little bit deeper, Mike Tannenbaum, the former GM of the Jets, saying that no free agent will want to sign with the Texans if Deshaun Watson's situation isn't clarified by the time free agency rolls around. To me, Seth, two things. One, I think the only types of free agents that are going to be making decisions hardcore based on where Deshaun's at with things, elite-level free agents that are looking to win Super Bowls. Well, I don't know that the Texans are in the market for any of those, even with Deshaun this year. Two, offensive players who go, you know what, I want to play with a high-level quarterback so I can put up some numbers. I don't know that the Texans should be spending a lot of money on the offensive side of the ball anyways, to be honest with you. This whole thing might be a decent restrictor plate for the Texans to keep them from doing anything silly in free agency. You know what I mean? Like, if part of the byproduct of Deshaun staying away from the team and not having a clear situation is that they've got to sit out this round of free agency, I don't think it's the worst thing in the world for the 2021 Houston Texans. This needs to be a year to clean up the mess from Bill O'Brien and Jack Easterby, not exacerbate the mess by maybe doing something irresponsible. And I don't think Nick Caserio would. I trust Nick Caserio. I do think Jack Easterby might, because I don't think he knows what he's doing when it comes to the salary cap, and we don't know what kind of say he has and stuff like this. But when I see, boy, the Texans aren't going to sign a bunch of free agents, I've kind of punted on 2021 anyways. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Let's get everything cleaned up from the nuclear fallout that was the Bill O'Brien general manager era, and then let's approach 2022 with a full complement of draft picks and normal cap space and no really, really boat anchor contracts on the ledger.
Yeah, I get nervous about that just because this would be the second phase now of us saying, hey, just be careful. Because during the season, I know some people were frustrated that the Texans didn't pull off a trade. That was the last thing I wanted. I didn't want the Texans dabbling in the trade market with Jack Easterby as the interim GM. Because frankly, I felt like that was the future GM's job at the time. I was a little bit more naive back then. I still wanted to believe that maybe Jack Easterby didn't have as much power and influence. I thought maybe he was going to be gone by February. Stupid. I was really dumb. Yeah. So, but I didn't want Jack East to be meddling with all that. I wanted the future GM to do it. Where now, okay, am I going to say once more, well, let's not make any drastic moves. Let's not move forward or anything until we find out what happened with Deshaun. But maybe this is the last stretch where I can say that.
Yeah.
Leading up to the draft, until you figure out exactly what's going to happen with Deshaun Watson, then don't do anything drastic. But if you – the thing is, Sean, you can't think, hey, if you lose Deshaun Watson, you're not going to have another quarterback for the next 3 or 4 years.
Right.
If one thing this offseason is demonstrating is you can go out and get a quarterback, a very viable quarterback like Matt Stafford. Last year, a Phillip Rivers, somebody like that. So retaining Will Fuller and keeping the rights to him isn't this boom or bust proposition in my mind. Mm-hmm. It's that if you somehow figure out a way to finagle yourself another quarterback, he's not going to be as good as Deshaun Watson, but still, there's still value in having Will Fuller on the team.
The Tyrann Mathews of the world, you know, when Tyrann Mathews signed here in 2018, my guess, you know, that was based, and keep in mind, he signed here off of a 4-12 season the year before, but Deshaun Watson's 6 games of being, you know, of rookie of the year, flashing rookie of the year potential for those 6 games. J.J. Watt coming back off of injury. This was a much more appealing place. Pre-Jack Easterby, let's call it what it is. This was a much more appealing place in 2018. I can't imagine, Seth, that any of those types of free agents, prove it type of guys, especially in the offensive side of the ball, are going to want to sign here without knowing what Deshaun Watson's situation is.
Right.
I think Tannenbaum is right about that part. If there's specific categories of free agent, I think that is a category they will struggle in finding guys.
Well, let's see. So the Jets in 2012 went 4-12. Mm-hmm. That was Tannenbaum's last year with the Jets. So the next year in free agency, when Tannenbaum wasn't there to reap the rewards of his 4-12 season,
right.
Who's going to be the quarterback in 2012 then? Was that
was it Sanchez still?
Was it Sanchez in 2012?
Well,
probably.
It
so
may have been, yeah.
I don't know, but it wasn't like the Jets were some prize marketplace of being. I don't. Let's see. Did they?
Why
sign
you bringing? Up, why are you bringing up the Jets?
Well, I want to see which. I want to see which free agents the Jets signed.
Oh, gotcha.
Tannenbaum saying that no free agents would want to come here.
Oh, okay.
And I'm sitting here and I'm looking at the transactions from 2013 after the Jets had an awful, awful season and they were the Jets. They signed a whole boatload of free agents. It's people still keep coming to teams as long as you're paying them the right kind of money.
All right. As you guys know, we've been working hard to help out Kids Meals Houston, texting the word Kids Meals to 20357. I say we, I mean you, the listeners as well, stepping up big over the weekend. For those who don't know, Kids Meals Houston feeds thousands of children under the age of 6 who don't have access to school-based free meals due to extreme poverty, and they lost all of their food in the power outage. And there were thousands of kids that had to get fed this week, and you guys have been stepping up huge. And joining us right now to talk a little bit more about that is the CEO of Kids Meals, Beth Braniff-Harp, joining us right now on Payne and Pendergast. Beth, you're on with Sean and Seth. It's good to talk to you this morning. How are you?
Good morning, and thanks for having us on to tell our story. I'm so appreciated.
Yeah, so go ahead. I mean, I kind of laid out the 15-second version of it there, but for those, and we've been talking about it obviously a lot on our shows and on our social media and so forth, but just for listeners that are just jumping in this morning, just give the 30-second elevator version of what you tell people Kids Meals is all about.
Yeah, Kids Meals is the nation's only home delivery service for preschool-age children that are living in severe poverty right here in Houston, and that's 1 in 4 kids. And so we are bringing a healthy meal right to their doorsteps, to their homes, apartments, and trailers. And on average, we serve about 6,000 children each weekday, which is remarkable in this amazing city that we're in that many kids need our help. But we're only able to serve about 22% of those that do need our help.
And so what's the best way for people to reach out to you guys and get to know more about you?
If they want to go to our website, it's kidsmealsinc.org. And if anybody wants to volunteer, we have a Take Action tab. You can actually volunteer from home. You can do the DIY packs and make those meals for the kids right from your own home, or you can sign up to come in. We've got a really safe environment following all the CDC procedures for COVID, and would love to help people because we cannot do it without volunteers. And then if anybody wants to donate, just $2 a day feeds a hungry child. And that's our all-in organizational cost. That's all the food, gas, van, staff, building, everything. And so we've gotten the BBB award several years for charity of excellence, and people can feel confident when they donate to Kids Meals that those dollars are going to feed Houston's hungriest children to make sure they're not going to bed hungry at night.
So Beth, take us through. We're talking to Beth Brand of Harp, the CEO of Kids Meals. You can text Kids Meals to 20357. Every little bit helps to feed some of these kids here in Houston that are living in extreme poverty. So take us through the last few days. When did you guys know during that power outage that this was going to turn into what it did, where you were basically doing a total restart from scratch?
Right. At first, we didn't know how bad it was because electricity kept going off and on, off and on. And then we brought in an expert that has been in the food service industry for over 30 years and walked the freezers and coolers with us at the end of last week. And it was heartbreaking. We literally had to throw out all of our perishable goods. So that means all the meat, the cheese, the milk, the juice, the produce, everything had to go. And we were so heartbroken. We usually have a backup of at least a week and a half, so that we are ready, and we had to start from scratch. But, I mean, I have to tell you, thanks to you guys, and thanks to everybody telling our story, Houston has stepped up, and we're so appreciative of everybody that's been reaching out to us.
Yeah, it's been incredible. How close are you guys to getting back to where you were before the power outages?
We'll show bless. We have a week worth of food now.
Good.
But you know what the problem is because with any disaster, there's increased need.
Yep.
So what we're seeing is an influx of applications coming to us. And we know that over the next coming weeks and months, the fallout from this is that so many more children and family are going to need our help. And on that line, we want to be a lifeline. We want to help anybody that needs help that has a child that's 5 and under in their home. They're living at or below poverty level. Their other kids qualify for free and reduced lunch. And we want you to go and apply. Go to our website at kidsmealsinc.org. Click the Need Help tab. And we want to be that resource for you. We want to get you on our routes and make sure that we are delivering meals to your home.
That's Kids Meals. Text Kids Meals, all one word, 20357. Kidsmealsinc.org is where you can check it out. Not just to donate, providing the meals. That's what my wife and I did this weekend, Beth. We did about 100 of the brown bags.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. But it was fun. Hey, look, on the heels of the power outage, it was kind of a fun scavenger hunt to go around all the different grocery stores and try to piece things together because it was hard to find some of the stuff. It's much easier now to find some of the things that are on the list. And you guys make it real easy. There's a real easy list of the categories of drinks and snacks that are acceptable to put into these lunch packs for the kids. So you can do the DIY stuff, you can donate, you can volunteer, many, many ways to help out these kids in need and help out Kids Meals Houston, kidsmealsinc.org. Text Kids Meals to 20357. Beth Brand of Harp, the CEO of Kids Meals, joining us. Beth, we really appreciate the time, the continued effort, and we will, as Houstonians, continue to step up for you guys.
Thank you again. We're so appreciative of your partnership. You know, you guys have done so much. You've helped us raise so much money over the last few days, and I'm just eternally grateful.
We're happy to do it, and we appreciate you making some time for us, Beth. Thank you.
Okay. All right. You guys take care.
You too. Bye-bye. Thanks, Beth Brand of Harp. Again, text Kids Meals to 20357. People stepping up huge. The Texans stepped up with a big donation to them over the weekend as well, so good stuff there. Who is more comfortable operating currently in this standoff, Deshaun Watson or the Texans? That's next. Sean Pendergast, Seth Payne with you on a Tuesday. So Deshaun Watson is dug in on his side of things, we think. He hadn't spoken publicly, but all indications are he does not want to be a Houston Texan anymore, and he's ready to do what needs to be done to make sure that a trade somewhere else happens. Meanwhile, the Texans are of mind that he's under contract, and they're going to do whatever it takes, presumably, I guess, to get him back in the fold and get him feeling good about the Texans once again. We'll see how long this staring contest goes on, Seth. I'm just curious, who do you think is more comfortable right now operating in this standoff mode? Deshaun Watson or the combination of Cal McNeister B. Serio, the three-headed monster of Cal, Nick, and Jack?
I like McNeister B. I think that Cal McNair and Jack Easterby are very comfortable because they have given themselves daily, if not hourly, pep talks about how everything's going to work out. And I do, I'm saying that half tongue in cheek, but I think that that's part of what Jack Easterby has sold Cal McNair on, is this extreme optimism. Some might call it a delusional optimism about certain about things working out. So I think they're very comfortable. I think they anticipate and expect that somehow, some way, Deshaun Watson's going to come back around. And that's what they're focused on. Caserio might be a little bit more pragmatic about it. And we don't know Caserio that well. You know, I get the sense a lot of people in New England don't know Caserio that well because he's all about just work. You know, he's all, everything I've heard about Caserio is that he is all about just, you know, squirreling away in a film room and going to work. And he does stuff on the field and he works with the players. It's not like he doesn't have people skills or anything. But I think when it comes to the human side of things or what have you, maybe he's not as concerned about it. And hopefully, I think maybe if he's got a little bit more of like a Belichick type of ability to divorce himself from the emotional side of things, he might see this situation for what it is and maybe take it a little bit more seriously than a Jack Easterby might.
My guess is that Deshaun Watson is completely uncomfortable doing what he's doing right now. You know, think about just how newsworthy it is when Russell Wilson or Aaron Rodgers made a little bit of a stink about what was going on with their teams, right? Like, that was headline-worthy stuff. Deshaun is basically dug in at home right now saying, I don't want to play for this team ever again, and he's demanding a trade at the age of 25, one season into a massive contract extension. And he comes from one of the best cultures in all of college football into the NFL, from Clemson. He comes from a place that truly does feel like family, where the patriarch of that program is somebody that does foster that type of nurturing environment, the productive, nurturing, but very hyper-competitive environment. He's in something now here that's just not that. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so my guess is that Deshaun Watson, not only the environment he's having to function in, but what he is, in his mind, feeling forced to do to force the issue is probably something that's completely foreign and uncomfortable to him.
This is where I worry that the extreme optimism might work against the Texans in this instance, because we get the sense, don't we, that Deshaun has been trying to raise these issues, that he's been trying to talk to Cal McNair, perhaps other people in the organization, about this stuff for some time, and that the message isn't being heard, and that if there is any chance here that Deshaun is just saber-rattling, you know, that he's just trying to shock or scare the Texans into some sense, into making some changes, I don't feel like the Texans are hearing any of that message whatsoever, right? And why? How could they, as long as Jack Easterby's around? Because Jack Easterby, according to many, many people, is one of the huge reasons there's an issue with the Texans culture right now. So Jack Easterby can't hear the message that, well, okay, Jack, I'm part of the problem. And it's a shame, because maybe if Easterby did hear that message, maybe they'd be able to figure out or convince a way to tell Deshaun that it is going to be different and it's going to be better. Because that's the only way, really, for this to work out. Because even if Deshaun comes back, this is why I don't get too wrapped up in people's notions about who has the leverage and who doesn't have the leverage. All right. Deshaun right now just flat out doesn't want to play for the Texans, apparently. So when your star quarterback comes back into the fold because the Texans have leverage, what exactly is so great about that situation?
Right.
What kind of leadership is he providing? What does it look like? You know, it just doesn't – nothing about that sounds like a championship environment. So it's got to be more than just about leverage. It's got to be about actually making substantial changes if you want to get him back. If Cal McNair and Jack Easterby think the solution to this is, hey, he's under contract, he's our guy, we've got the leverage, then they haven't heard a single thing that Deshaun has said. And so maybe they have heard those messages. Maybe they're trying to figure it out. Maybe that's part of the reason they hired the people that they did, the coaching staff, all of that. Maybe they're working towards creating a different kind of environment. The problem is that it all still feels like it's Jack Easterby's master plan to get Josh McCown the head coaching job 2 years from now.
Yeah, yeah. Would it be playing out any different? It's interesting you bring up the contract, because it gets me thinking, would this be playing out any different if Deshaun had not signed his deal in September? You know, that's being lauded as this thing right now. Boy, it's a good thing they got him to sign that contract in September, because they at least they've got him locked up, and to use your word, to use the L word, leverage, at least they've got some semblance of leverage. Seth, I feel like if he hadn't signed the deal, they would just be saber rattling with the franchise tag right now. Like, look, he, you know, we still control him this year. It's his fifth year option, and we've got the franchise tag that we can use three times. So we've got this thing under control. You know, if Deshaun wants to go anywhere, just know that we've got him under control for the next few years thanks to the franchise tag.
The team, in some respects, lost some leverage by giving him that contract, just in the sense that if Deshaun were holding out right now and he didn't have a long-term contract, he could say that it was about the culture. He could say it was all these things, or people close to him could say it was about all those things, and nobody would believe him because they would think that it was all about the money. There's a moral hazard there. Mm. There'd be a moral hazard involved with threatening a holdout right now. If he didn't have the contract.
Yeah.
Because he has the contract, This can be completely about the non-financial issues, which puts him much closer in alignment with fans than a star athlete holding out typically is. Usually when a star athlete holds out, fans are not all that sympathetic because it's somebody trying to make a lot more money than they are right now. It has nothing to do with actually winning a championship or what have you. With Deshaun, it's very much all about the kind of stuff that the fans do care about. And I think that's why there's more lopsided support for the athlete than there typically is in these situations.
The irony in the illustration you put forth there is that just looking at it conventionally, I think there'd be a lot of fans going, well, why he's staying? He's under contract. You know, regardless of what the reasons are, you're under contract to the team. You need to show up in the offseason. You can't demand a trade. You signed a contract. The way you illustrate it, and I agree with you, is that in this case, the culture is so bad in the building there that the contract is actually something that works in Deshaun's favor from a public relations standpoint.
Yeah.
Like, it's obviously not about money. He's got money. He got the money. It's so bad that this guy, who's never been a bad seed his whole life, is looking at the situation and having to do things that people would normally be pointing at him saying, guy's a bad seed right there.
Right. And that's where you can't forget any. That's one of the first things I usually say when I go on in other markets is, listen, you guys have to understand, Deshaun has never complained about anything, almost to his detriment, because people this last year were criticizing him for not being sad enough. Why isn't Deshaun more sad? I want him to be sad all the time. Because he's staying positive. He's always doing the right thing. He publicly and passionately defended Bill O'Brien when everybody, you know, myself included, was extremely critical of Bill O'Brien. That's why it's notable. When somebody who has never complained before all of a sudden complains and says, hey, this is really a big deal, then my gut, and I think most people's gut, is and should be to say, oh, okay, I better listen to this. This isn't some malcontent that's always complaining about something. This isn't just some guy that's going to complain no matter how well everything's going in his life. This probably means something. So that's where I am with it. And there's just so many. I mean, how much evidence do we need? How much evidence do we need against Jack Easterby before some people start actually believing it?
Yeah.
It's astounding. It's really incredible.
It's not
just Easterby. I mean, it's the whole shebang.
Yeah. Text message, Deshaun is losing fans as this goes on. Maybe. Perhaps. Look, it's hard for it to go in any direction other than him losing fans because the support had been so overwhelmingly in his favor from jump that, I could see that with more and more time going on with him being silent and not actually speaking out in his own words. I could see where he'd be losing. I don't think he's losing him in droves or anything like that. Probably just little trickles here and there.
Yeah, and that's where I think there's been a pretty loud minority this entire time telling me that, like, no, Seth, you're wrong. People hate Deshaun now. And they'll tell me to go look at message boards and whatnot, and I do, and it still seems pretty lopsided that more people support Deshaun. Now, the negative or the dissenting opinion in any matter is usually going to be louder and have more vocal people because they feel they have to be. But I'm just telling you, I've seen a lot of disputes between players and organizations. This is the most lopsided I've seen in favor of the player. Yes, there are plenty of people that are anti-Deshaun. I'm just saying, compared to other situations like this, Deshaun has way more support from the local fans than any other athlete usually does.
You're an NFL team that needs a quarterback. Trade packages are equal. Would you trade for Russell Wilson or Deshaun Watson? That's next. Michael Silver of the NFL Network was on yesterday, and Deshaun Watson's not the only quarterback that teams are kicking tires on and making phone calls to front offices. Seattle is getting phone calls right now about Russell Wilson.
internally, they got the message. They're not thrilled that their quarterback felt that way. And teams have been calling. Probably a third of the league have reached out to inquire about Russell Wilson. And remember, Seahawks general manager John Schneider is not one of those people who ever says, we have nothing to talk about. He listens to anything and everything all the time. And so that doesn't mean that there are actual trade talks going on, but certainly teams have reached out.
All right, so teams are reaching out to the Seattle Seahawks, same way teams are reportedly reaching out to the Houston Texans. They may be getting a friendlier ear from John Schneider in Seattle, it would appear, according to Michael Silver. One more from Silver here. What would a trade package for Russell Wilson look like?
What's a realistic price if the Seahawks were to trade Russell Wilson? I think you start with something like 3 first-round draft picks. That's kind of the message that other teams believe, would be conveyed. But, you know, I still think there is a lot of time to get through this rough patch. He's under contract for 3 more years. He's obviously done some incredible things in that city and for that franchise, and the Seahawks certainly know what they have.
Seth, it sounds like they could have taken an old Michael Silver soundbite that was talking about Deshaun Watson and the Texans and just spliced in Russell Wilson and the Seahawks. And it sounds like the exact same take.
Well, because that wasn't an actual, he wasn't reporting what the offers were or anything. Right. He was kind of saying, what should it be? Yeah, okay, I'll splice in what we said for Deshaun.
Right.
I have a hard time with Silver sometimes because he sounds like a cross between Harry Carey and Seth Payne, where I just I can't take that man serious. He sounds like a drunker version of myself sometimes.
He
like,
does. Got a weird voice.
Russell Wilson.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
I got to tell you, it's going to take at least 3 first-round picks for Russell Wilson.
There's Office Pete again having hot takes on football. So, Seth, the answer may be different depending on which team you're talking about here, but just to simplify it, if the trade packages are equal, because that's the same exact trade package we hear when people talk about Deshaun Watson, it would start with 3 first-round picks. Mm. And these are undoubtedly, to me, Russell Wilson and Deshaun Watson are 2 of the top half dozen or so quarterbacks in the league, to me, without question. Which, if the packages were equal, would you be more likely to trade for if you were an NFL general manager, Russell Wilson or Deshaun Watson?
I would go with Deshaun Watson, and I actually had a much harder time with that than it sounded. The biggest sticking point for me is durability, because you remember that Deshaun had a knee injury in college too.
Mm-hmm.
So he's stacked it up now with ACLs in both legs and all these other issues. But there's something about Deshaun's newfound beefiness that makes me feel a lot better about his durability. He's bulked up quite a bit in the last couple of years, and not obviously, it's not in a way that has hurt his throwing motion
at all
or anything. I think he just kind of, it looked like he started taking his weightlifting seriously. He's got stronger legs. Some of his best plays this year were really more about his physical strength than his speed. His ability to stay standing while he had defenders draped off of him. A lot of that is just that muscle that he's put on his frame. So he's a thicker guy now than he was before. Because both Russell Wilson and Deshaun Watson are going to take some abuse. They're both going to take hits. They just, even though Deshaun has gotten a lot better at, on average, getting rid of the ball quickly, there still are those plays where he's going to extend the play. Sometimes for greatness, sometimes it ends up being a sack, but he's going to take those hits. I feel better about him now, and because he's younger, and because he now has that body mass where he looks more durable, I think youth and potential for more upside with him, and this is a big one, Deshaun's a natural leader, whereas with Russell Wilson, it's always felt kind of forced. And, you know, you remember the stories about how he didn't get along with a lot of the veterans on that team.
Yeah.
Because he didn't have enough dog in him or what have you. I think Deshaun's got plenty of dog in him. And I think that guys on the team see him as one of them, not some guy who's set apart from everybody.
Russell Wilson's a great quarterback. There's no question about it. Before Patrick Mahomes made his rise to power, I was somebody touting Russell Wilson as the best quarterback in football. Mahomes is that now. But Russell Wilson is undoubtedly one of the top 3 or 4. But yes, Seth, he's corny. He's just corny as hell. Like I'm with you. I would pick Deshaun as well. And look, 5-6 years difference in age, that cannot be sneezed at either. If you're a Texan fan, look, this Russell Wilson Seattle thing is probably going to work itself out. I don't think this is going to result in him getting traded from the Seahawks. I don't think. But if you had asked me the same thing about Deshaun 4 months ago, I would have said, yeah, right. Deshaun Watson's going to get traded. But if you're a Texan fan and you're looking for a dog in the fight in this Wilson Seahawks thing, I would root for the two of them to make up, because if you're going to move on from Deshaun Watson, and it looks like the Texans may have to, supply and demand. The fewer elite quarterbacks there are out there, the better a package you're going to get for Deshaun Watson. It's simple economics, Seth.
The problem with the whole Russell Wilson stuff was that it just felt orchestrated. It felt like everything Russell Wilson does, where it's just got a little too shiny of a veneer, and you don't feel like you're getting an actual or genuine sentiment. And I could see why the Seahawks front office would be pissed off about him coming out and saying it on the Dan Patrick show. Because I didn't get the sense that he had voiced those concerns with the Seahawks themselves.
Yeah.
At the very least, do me the honor of telling me to our face first. Maybe he did, but I didn't really get the sense that he did. And that he also, even though, you know, a quarterback talking about his offensive line is one of those things where just because it's true doesn't mean that you should be saying it out loud. That's one of those natural leadership type of things that Russell Wilson, I don't think, has. He doesn't have a feel for it the way Deshaun Watson does. Now, Deshaun did have that one moment at the end of the season a couple years ago where he criticized the offensive line. Right. But that was one little blip, and it was from a much younger quarterback than Russell Wilson is now. That's the part of Russell Wilson that rubs people the wrong way.
That was also 5 minutes after a playoff loss that ended the season. Russell Wilson has had a month to decompress, and he goes on the Dan Patrick show and says that stuff. You're right. It's a totally different situation than Deshaun saying it with, you know, adrenaline and testosterone still coursing through his veins from a loss at home to the Colts by 2 touchdowns.
And Russell Wilson is saying it as all these other quarterbacks are getting the attention for the trade movement and what have you.
Yeah.
It feels a little too perfect that Russell Wilson can say, hey, remember, I'm here too. I was on the Super Bowl talking to Goodell. I looked very miserable, so I could say afterwards that the reason I looked miserable was because I was upset that I wasn't playing in the game.
I may need...
That's what he said. He said that's why he looked miserable at the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
I wanted to be out there. Yeah. I wanted to be out there with the guys. He's playing the game.
He did look miserable, that's for sure. I may need to put a poll up and see who people would like. If it all things being equal, Deshaun or Russell Wilson, you and I are unanimous on that. A unanimous vote of two people, Seth and Sean, that we would take Deshaun Watson over Russell Wilson in a trade. I just put up a poll, Seth, because I do feel like we need to take the temperature on this. That texter who said, boy, Deshaun's losing fans by the day here, got me thinking. And I put time to do a heat check, Pender poll. Put simply, are you team Deshaun or are you team Texans front office?
I just realized that. I helped you compose that.
Yeah.
And now that I hear it out loud.
Does it sound bad?
That's going to be heavily weighted in Deshaun's favor. Yeah. Well, the original thing you said, are you team Deshaun or team Texans? And I felt like that was putting the vote. That was putting a little too much pressure on the person taking the poll.
Yeah.
So this really does boil down to Deshaun versus the front office. That's who the fight is between those two entities. So yeah.
We're a few hundred votes in. I don't think Deshaun needs to worry about losing this battle anytime soon. Just judging on the early returns, 82% in favor of Deshaun Watson. 713-572-4610. Let's drop a phone call in here before we get to some headlines. JT is on a mobile. JT, welcome into Payne and Pendergast.
Good morning, gentlemen. I have a couple of things I want to ask y'all's opinion on and see what y'all say.
Okay.
At first with Deshaun Watson, it seemed like he was being a little childish until he stepped forward and said, hey, I want to trade. So, you know, he cleared everything up on that respect. I don't think his problem is really with Jack Easter Bunny. I really don't. Because the last thing we heard about him was Easter Bunny, he basically said, you know, thank you for helping me with my contract. So I think everything is with Cal McNair. Now, that's just what I think. But now, is this going to set a dangerous precedent if he gets his way and now players are going to start meddling in the front office where they normally, it was kind of taboo? I mean, I remember they complained about their coaches and the staffing and whatnot. But I've never really heard them so much get into the front office much. But I've also never heard owners taking players out to dinner publicly and saying, oh, yeah, well, I'm going to get his opinion on things. You know, they did it privately, but they didn't make it public so much.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I'll hang up the list.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, JT.
I guess Did JT say, would it set a dangerous precedent, or did he just say a precedent?
Just a precedent. Yeah, well, there's a negative connotation to the trend he's talking about here.
Yeah, I guess that's where I've never had the negative opinion of that. Maybe I did at one point, but it's been a long time ago, because when I used to feel that way, at one point I realized, wait a second, why are we assuming that the front offices actually know what they're doing?
Yeah.
Because the more I learn about pro sports, the more dumbfounded I am at times by the decision-making process and how decisions are made by some front offices. So it makes things a lot murkier and messier. People love the idea of a chain of command, and they like being able to know who's making the decisions and who's doing what. Modern sports, if you look at it, is – I think, yes, slanted more towards the star athletes having more control than they used to. And I'm okay with it. I'm obviously biased, having been a former professional athlete, but I've also seen that side of it where sometimes the star athlete does know what's best. And it, at the very least, that doesn't mean the star athlete has to call the shots, but he should be listened to.
Yeah.
And then you might get some mega battles, but you know where else you get mega battles? Within front offices, in any other organization that exists in the history of humankind. It's not always cut and dried where one guy's making all the decisions at the top with no input from anybody underneath. It's one more dynamic added to it, but I don't think it's nothing that you should necessarily be afraid of.
No, I think what needs to be pointed out with this specific situation, because this is the situation we care most about, is here with the Texans, is that it's not as though Deshaun kept going in on a daily basis, banging on Cal McNair's door, demanding input on things. It's not as though Cal was dragged begrudgingly into a Deshaun Watson discussion about the future of the organization. By reports, they went to Deshaun and looked for his input. They sought his input, and then, depending on what reports you believe, Deshaun was promised that he would at least be kept apprised of things. And when he wasn't kept apprised of things, that's when it all kind of fell apart for this team. That was the genesis of the true discontent for Deshaun Watson.
Yeah, and I think also it comes down to an individual matter. I mean, there are a lot of athletes that flat out don't want the pressure or the responsibility or the distraction of being involved in personnel situations. You know, Tom Brady would always claim, and I believe him for the most part in most situations, that he never talked to Belichick at all about personnel, because it's hard when you're the quarterback, when all of a sudden you become the guy that's responsible for getting guys cut or getting guys signed or any of that. Then all of a sudden, it's heavy as the head that wears the crown.
Yes.
You know, when you want to be the lovable guy in the locker room that's, you know, leading as one of the boys, there's a separation there between you. And to be clear, we never really got a sense that Deshaun was doing that as much as him. He publicly said those guys aren't getting traded during the season. I think that was as everything was unraveling and nobody knew who actually was in charge. Like, so when Deshaun said that during the season at the trade deadline, that them boys ain't getting traded or whatever he said, at the time, I didn't realize just how tumultuous everything was.
Yeah.
Now I kind of get it. Now I understand where Deshaun was. So does it set a dangerous precedent, or does it set a precedent? If what you're worried about is that in a situation where some charismatic, quasi-faith leader has taken psychological control of the owner and that the star quarterback has an issue with that somehow, then yeah, maybe it sets a precedent. And I'm frankly all for that precedent. I'm all for anybody that's going to expose what the hell is going on with the Texans right now.
Yeah. All right, let's do some headlines.
Payne and Pendergast with today's headlines, brought to you by BaywayJeep.com.
All right, we start with the Astros. They had their first team workout of spring training yesterday. Carlos Correa gave his assessment of the team. He said they're looking good.
I feel solid right now. So I was talking to Altuve today. I was like, damn, this is the best we've ever looked in the first workout of spring training. Because he also put in the work, you know. I saw him putting in the work, taking ground balls, hitting BP almost every day. I was doing the same. So when we showed up today, we showed up, you know, in great shape. Even Dusty Baker told us, you know, you guys showed up ready to go. And, you know, we showed up because we want to win another championship and we want to perform to the best of our abilities. And, you know, for us to do that, we had to go out there in the offseason and put in the work to show up ready for spring training.
Seth, it's early, and we're only getting a few sound bites here and there. It's only been one workout and one media session for some of these guys. We haven't even heard from Altuve himself yet. But if I'm coming away with a theme into spring training here for these guys, between Correa and Bregman, it feels like the short season last year was, in a weird way, kind of a wake-up call for some of these guys. I don't know that it should have been, but that's how they're treating it.
That's how they're treating it, and it feels like a team that went to the ALCS last year feel like they're scrappy underdogs. You know, like they have that scrappy underdog mentality, and they feel hungry and not one bit complacent. Not that they ever seemed like a complacent team before, but yeah, I guess re-energized or reinvigorated. That's how it seems so far, and Bregman spoke about that, just how he wasn't happy with his performance last year, how it just kind of feels like last year didn't even actually happen. And I would imagine that's probably similar to a lot of teams around the league.
Yeah.
I'm certain physically it didn't feel like they played an entire season, because they didn't. So there's probably a lot of guys with a lot of pep in their step that are pretty fresh and ready to go right now.
Bregman's reportedly put on 27 pounds. Where the hell is Alex Bregman going to put 27 pounds without it being a big beer gut? It's like because I saw pictures or images of him recently. Like, he looks pretty similar. You know, he's got a jersey on, so it's tough to tell. He's not a big dude to begin with. He reportedly put on 27 pounds of muscle.
He's never had a muscled up physique,
right?
Really, and he's also, it's not like he's super lean either.
And yet he hits 40 home runs every year.
yeah. So it's going to go one of two ways. It's either going to be incredible, he's going to add power to his game, even more power to his game, or it's going to affect his throwing motion, his ability to move, all that stuff. And we'll see. I get nervous when guys change their body types dramatically, because sometimes all that extra weight isn't, you were at your best weight. Now, Kyle Tucker is apparently beefed up a little bit, and that's what I'm excited about, because I always told you I felt like Kyle Tucker was one scoop of creatine per day away from some serious hardcore production, because he was like, when it's not going well for him, there are a lot of warning track fly balls. This will potentially put him past the warning track.
You have been team PED for Kyle Tucker for a long time. Yes.
Well, legal PEDs.
Team legal PEDs for Kyle Tucker.
I like PESs, performance enhancing supplements.
Supplements. Okay, yes. Sounds good. PESs. The other big headline coming out of Astros spring training, also from Carlos Correa, he said he wants to be an Astro for life a few weeks ago, but right now, contract talks, not happening.
But right now, there's no talks about it. I haven't heard from them since the arbitration was settled. That's where we are right now.
Seth, which side benefits more from just cooling off and not doing a deal before the season? Carlos Correa or the Astros? This feels like a negotiation where the window for what the number could end up being is massive between Correa and the Astros.
This is all about whether or not he gets injured this year.
Yeah.
I think that the longevity, the durability, that's a number one, the issue with Carlos Correa. When he's been healthy, he's been an MVP candidate. When his production has lagged, you can almost always tie it to his back or ribs or something. And it's with clockwork precision, when he's healthy, he's an MVP caliber player. Since 2015, he's got the second best or the third best WARs among shortstops since 2015, because when he's healthy and when he's producing, he produces really, really well. He's incredible defensively, and I think we saw a side of his personality last year that I think honestly baseball people probably can appreciate too, not just fans. So if he stays healthy, he's going to make over $300 million. If he gets injured two times and he only plays 90 games or something, then it's going to benefit the Astros.
Yeah.
So it all depends. Right now, if Carlos Correa stays healthy throughout this season and he doesn't sign a deal beforehand, then that'll be the gamble that paid off for him.
I'm shocked by that stat you just gave me. Say that again. He's second among shortstops since 2015. So his
really
rookie
since
year.
Since he came up, yeah.
He's second among shortstops.
Let me find the actual stat, Sean, so I don't misrepresent anything.
Okay. I'm shocked because WAR, wins above replacement, It's not an average. It's a cumulative counting stat, and he's missed so much time.
Right, he's missed so much time. Okay, here it is. And I believe I got this in The Athletic, so from Kaplan there.
Yep.
Let's see. Since his June 2015 debut, he is second among full-time shortstops to only Lindor since 2015. By F-War, blah, blah, blah. Among that foursome, so it's Bogarts, Lindor, and Seager.
Okay, good players.
Those are the four top full-time shortstops, and Lindor's at the top of those four. Among that foursome, Correa ranks third in games played.
Yeah.
It's 604 games. So he's been very, very productive, and he's accumulated those stats while he's been healthy. And it just shows you how good he is when he's healthy. Because even the poor production when he's banged up or the missed games, he's still that high up there with that few games played. He's just that good. And in front offices, it's going to depend, I think, on a team-by-team basis how they evaluate the risk of injuries and whether guys are indeed injury-prone or if it's just bad luck. And I think him staying healthy for an entire season would probably – make a lot of front offices think, okay, you know what? Maybe he just had really bad luck, and these back stretches that he's doing now seems to be the ticket for him. So, yeah, I feel good about paying him a boatload of money.
All right, we'll talk more Astros as the show goes on. Shifting gears over to the – did you have one more thing?
Real quick.
Yeah.
One other thing about the WAR, because it's called wins above replacement. Okay. So you kind of think in your mind, like, okay, how many extra wins are you going to get because of this guy? That stat matters to front offices, no matter how they calculate their own WAR, because even despite the injuries – that means that, wow, Carlos Correa has provided that many extra wins to his team. Mm-hmm. So even though he hasn't been there, he's still been way more valuable than a lot of these other shortstops. So it makes the injuries a little less of a concern because when he is out there producing, he's producing so much more.
That's good stuff. All right, the Rockets. Not much good stuff going on with the Rockets these days. They lose their eighth game in a row last night. The Chicago Bulls come to town. They win 120-100 over the Rockets. Eric Gordon states the obvious here.
Situations like this is always tough, and all you got to do is look forward to the next thing and get out of it. And it's been tough, you know. We're all in a little bit of a funk, and guys are playing hard. We're just not playing as smart, and we're just not hitting shots either.
Sounds like Eric Gordon brought his dog to the Zoom conference call after the game. I'm assuming that was one of the reporters doing the Zoom from home, their dog in the background. That was
on the mute, man.
Eric Gordon. Yeah, I don't get that. These media people that don't know how to use the mute button. Anyways, or they mute and they don't know how to unmute. Like, hey, you need to turn your mute off.
That's where I stop criticizing.
I'm not going to name names. I'm not going to name names. Rhymes with Schmark Schmerman. Eric Gordon talking about the rough patch of Rockets basketball. Seth, it's exacerbated by the fact that I was looking this up this morning, the standings in the NBA. The Brooklyn Nets are on a 6-game winning streak. The Washington Wizards are on a 5-game winning streak. And even the Phoenix Suns, sitting at 4th in the Western Conference right now after years of being a lottery team, they're on a nice, modest 3-game winning streak. What do those teams have in common? They all have former all-star backcourt people for the Rockets on their squad. James Harden, Russell Westbrook, and Chris Paul's teams are all on anywhere from modest to very impressive winning streaks right now.
If you look at the Nets and the way they're playing basketball and the way people all of a sudden are realizing that James Harden can pass, has it changed the way – because it was all so ugly with Harden – and understandably so, and I'm guilty of just being pretty angry at Harden for the way it all went down. But if at some point they'd figured out a way to get a Kevin Durant on the squad alongside a Kyrie Irving, and you look at those three guys are the best in the league at ISO possessions right now. It really is. Phil Jackson would have already claimed credit for creating some kind of a triangle offense where he's genius. It's all about Zen and triangles and quadrilateral formations and parallelograms because when Harden passes to Durant and then Durant passes to Kyrie, turns out that's a pretty good thing to do. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Those guys, it's a whole matter of like, oh, Harden, oh, Should I dribble a bunch or should I pass it to Kevin Durant?
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
Oh wow. Everybody's trying. They're trying to triple team both Durant and me at the same time. That math doesn't work out. Here you go, Kyrie. That if maybe you had ever actually built a team quite like this around Harden, he'd still be in Houston.
I'm so conflicted because I was really angry at Harden, and I still am angry about the way he left here. Like, I just, for an organization that bent over backwards for him, I thought it was classless the way he left here. Now, that said, I really am rooting for a Lakers versus Nets NBA Finals. I think that would be...
Oh, just for the showdown?
Just for the showdown. Yeah. That would be fun as hell. Kevin Durant, James Harden, and Kyrie Irving versus LeBron James and Anthony Davis and everybody else on the Lakers. That would be fun as hell. You know, that would be an old school East Coast versus West Coast kind of thing. I know the Nets, you know, old school would be Celtics Lakers. That would be true old school. But as much as I'm, as much as like in a vacuum, I'm rooting against James Harden because I don't like the way he left. As a basketball fan, that's the matchup I want to see. I don't feel like seeing the Sixers versus the Lakers. I don't feel like seeing the Bucks versus the Lakers. I'm looking at the Eastern, the Pacers. Like, I mean, we really start to get down to, after the Nets, we start to get the teams. I'm just not all that. I mean, I know the Bucks have Giannis and whatnot, but I want to see the Nets and the Lakers in the NBA Finals.
Have you softened at all towards Harden because he's been pretty active in this relief these last couple days?
Yes. Yes, that is
hard not to. I saw you. I saw you compliment him on social media.
I did.
I mean, obvious. You'd like to think you're above sports and things like that, but there is that is a little bit of a reminder to me. Like, all right, yeah, we're all human, aren't we?
Yeah. I think he still loves Houston. I think Deshaun Watson loves Houston. I just don't think they were in particular. They just didn't like the situations that they were in. Deshaun is handling his, I think, more justifiably than James handled his.
What are we calling this whole ordeal, by the way? Winter Storm 21, or what's is there a name for it yet? I feel like I've seen it references a few different things.
Well, there's a, and we should mention this too. There, we definitely should mention this. The Texans sent out a press release yesterday, and they're calling it the 2021 Winter Storm. Janice McNair and the Houston Texans donated $500,000 toward the Greater Houston Harris County 2021 Winter Storm Relief Fund. So there you go, Seth. It's the 2021 Winter Storm. Hey, real quick.
We got to come up with something.
Real quick, I just got to get this in. You're listening to KILT and KILT HD2, a radio.com station. Continue.
You know, yesterday our listeners did a great job coming up for things that they might call Texans fans or the Texans if they end up having an historically bad run like the New Orleans Saints when they became the New Orleans Aints. And I thought our listeners did a pretty good job. Let's try to rename this winter storm, which wasn't really a storm. It was a cold snap, right?
There were remember there was freezing rain and snow the first day of it.
And then again on Wednesday.
I walked to work 3 days in a row and slipped a bunch of times. I can tell you.
I don't think of that as a storm. I guess without extreme wind, I don't think of it.
You didn't land on your ass 4 times last week.
Yeah, I know, but that's like a freezing rain, you know, like the ice over or something like that. That would be something more appropriate. Text in 713-572-4610.
Okay, give us a name for the weather conditions from last week. 713.
If it's not extreme wind, I don't consider it a storm.
724-610. I'm trying to remember if it was windy. I can't remember. It was definitely very, very icy. Good job, by the way, by the Texans. $500,000 bucks, man. Texans have been stepping up big time over these last few days. They donated a bunch of money to Kids Meals Houston as well. You can donate money by texting Kids Meals to 20357.